You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Everybody get some good rest last night? A few of you weren't here last night, so we'll maybe do a very, very brief recap, but I think most of you were here. Looking forward to this morning. I think we have a couple of different sessions coming up, so there's a lot about Jacob's life. Is this too loud? Am I right? Okay. A lot about Jacob's life, which we're not going to be able to cover, although I do hear there's a book somebody's written called Limping with God that covers the entire life of Jacob. So whatever we don't get to, if you're really interested in it, then chances are I've talked about it somewhere in the book. But I do want to focus mainly this morning upon kind of where we left off last night, picking up there and then just taking us through kind of the midpoint of Jacob's life. We're not going to be able to talk about some of the material that's toward the end because that kind of bleeds over into the Joseph story. And on Monday with the staff, I'm going to be talking about the Joseph story, and I don't want to steal my own thunder, so I've got to save that for later. We might tiptoe into one little part of the Jacob story. We'll see kind of where we're at when we get toward the end of Jacob's life. We'll see kind of where we're at the end of our time this morning. So last night, we got introduced to Jacob, and we all decided together, we took a vote, in fact, that he is the most likable character in the Bible. Just an upstanding kind of guy, the kind of guy that you want your children to grow up and be like. Or maybe not. Now, what we did is we kind of dove into those ugly characteristics of Jacob that you really don't have to work that hard to see. I mean, they're glaring, they're right in your face. You see right away what kind of person he is. And then we led through those early stories and we culminated then in that one little story of the stairway leading up to heaven. And talked about how the God who appeared to him there did not appear with a tongue lashing or wagging of the finger or any condemnation, in fact, whatsoever. He spoke to him nothing but words of grace and kindness and promise, which is shocking in a very good gospel kind of way. Because it turns out that's exactly what the gospel is. The gospel comes up to us sinners who are just like Jacob. And rather than the gospel wagging its finger in our face or giving us a tongue lashing, it says, you are forgiven. I love you. I'm your God. I'm going to be with you. I'm going to bring you back. And I'm going to do that not because of anything within you that is drawing my heart toward you, but because of who I am. I'm the God who loves and forgives. So that's kind of where we left off last night. And we'll pick up there by talking about actually what's happening to Jacob, what he's beginning to experience. And that is, it's a key biblical theme. In fact, it's become for me kind of a defining characteristic of the scriptures, the story of the scriptures, and then also of our own lives. And this key theme is exile. So when I talk about exile, I just usually ask you to begin to think through the biblical story. You don't have to open up your Bible. You don't have to turn to this book or this chapter. Just kind of think through the big story itself. All the people who in some very major sorts of ways, and in some cases minor sorts of ways, were uprooted from what they knew, and sent either willingly or sometimes unwillingly into a place where they were not rooted, where they were kind of wandering around, where they were sometimes in the middle of chaos and confusion, and where they looked to the future and it was all dark because they had no idea what was coming next. So, as you think through the biblical story, what's the first exile? Genesis chapter 3. Adam and Eve are, now this was an unwilling exile. They're kicked out of paradise. And they're entering into the unknown. What will be next? They've left everything that they've known, and now they're entering into the unknown. And God tells them that it's not going to be pleasant. Thorns and thistles, pains in childbirth, all of these things that, well, of course, still define our lives today. So they leave the place of paradise, and they enter into the unknown land of exile. But that's just the beginning. What's next? Yeah, you literally turn the page, and now you have Cain. And he goes into exile because of the murder of his brother. So you have Adam and Eve. You have their son sent into exile. And then, what's the next one? You could call the flood an exile. I mean, certainly everything that Noah and his family had known is now gone, like literally washed away. And all they know now is the boat. And the boat's going here and there, and who knows where it's going to end up. It's going to end up where God wants it to be. Now, the first exile after that is significant because it's sort of a precursor to another exile that is to come. I'm talking about what happens in Genesis 12. This is when we're introduced to the elderly couple, Abram and Sarai, Abraham and Sarah. And they go into exile where? Egypt, because of a famine. And what happens when they get down there? Well, Sarai is taken into Pharaoh's house, right? And then what does God do to Pharaoh? He sends plagues upon him. And then Abram and Sarai do what? They leave. They leave poor or rich? Rich. That ring any bells? This is a precursor to what's going to happen to Abraham and Sarah's descendants. So this is, as it were, the movie trailer for the full movie that is to come in the Exodus. Because once more, the people of God, the descendants of Abraham and Sarah, end up in Egypt because of a famine. And while they're there, they get in trouble with Pharaoh. And God sends the 10 plagues on Pharaoh. And then eventually, the descendants of Abraham and Sarah leave laden with the goods of Egypt. So that's all the first two books of the Bible. It's just Genesis and Exodus. And we could go on from there to talk about, for instance, the exile of Naomi and her family in the book of Ruth, where they had to leave because of a famine. They go to a foreign country, and eventually they come home. But they don't come home rich. Naomi comes home empty and bitter. And then there's the one we're going to talk about today, and that is Jacob's exile. And there's more that we could have talked about, but you get kind of the feel. Exiles are scattered throughout all the scriptures, and Jacob is going to experience his own. And we do too, right? So exile doesn't have to be that you're uprooted literally and you have to move somewhere else. It can mean that you experience something in your life that throws you into a place of confusion and you don't know for sure when it's going to end. And everything that you thought was secure is no longer secure. Everything you thought you could count on, kind of the way you had your life mapped out, as it were, well, that map's been burned. And now you don't know where you're going. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow or next week or next year. Everything that was stable and secure is gone. And now you're wondering, God, what are you doing to me? Where are you? What's going to happen? That's what it feels like to be in exile. I've been through two major exiles in my life. The first one was when I was in my mid-30s, when I blew up my life and lost everything in which I had invested my identity, all those things I had done. And I was in a state of confusion and chaos for a number of years. Until God had mercy upon me, and he kind of pulled me out of the darkness, and he began to give me a new map, as it were, so that I had a better idea as to where I needed to be and where he wanted me to go. So that was several years ago. And then I got into a much better place. Stacy and I married. We had a very good life. Still have a very good life. Everything was going great. And then last year happened to us, and we lost our son, Luke, in the middle of the year. And then 2-3 months later, my dad died. And so I still feel like I'm actually in exile because things have not worked themselves out. There's still chaos, there's still confusion, there's still uncertainty, there's still, like, I can see the beginnings of a map, you know, but it's not very clear, you know, where do we go from here? Because the future is still dim and even dark at times, even though we have the light of hope always with us. When you're going through grief, there's twists and turns, and you don't always know what's going to confront you. So we're in this sort of exile of grief, this long period of mourning. What's going to be next? We don't know. But we do know that whatever is next, that next is not going to be without God. God will be there. So maybe we turn a corner, and there's something that's frightening. Fear no evil, because Christ is with you. Or maybe we turn a coin, there's something bright and great, wonderful, and Christ is there also. So whatever your exile, maybe you're in one right now. Maybe you've been in one for quite a while, or maybe yours will begin tomorrow. Life is uncertain. We don't know. And that is why now we always root ourselves in the biblical story about exile and return, about entering into this space of confusion and darkness and chaos, and then knowing that in the midst of that place, God is actually not absent, but fully present, to be doing there in our lives often things He could not have done because of us when everything was great. That's one of the painful lessons of life, is that very often in those times when we feel the most out of control is when God is the most active, doing things in our lives that He wouldn't have been able to do otherwise because we're too comfortable. We're too secure. We're too often full of ourselves. And so what God often does is He comes along and he takes the plug out the bottom of us, and a lot of us drains out, and then He's able to fill up that vacuum with more of Himself. Less of me, more of Jesus. And often that happens in periods of exile. So exile is never fun, but what happens there, what God does there, bears fruit in our lives that we maybe don't see initially, certainly don't see in exile, but in later years as we're looking back, we're like, oh, okay, now I see what the Lord was doing back in those days. So Jacob is, as we talked about last night, he's entering exile with a lot. He's got a stick. he's got a staff in his hand. But as I also pointed out, he also has a word in his pocket. He has this promise from God that He's going to be with him, protect him, bless him, and then bring him back eventually to where He wants him to be. So that kind of takes us into his time in Haran. So just if you have your Bibles, or if you have your Bible app and you want to follow along, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 29. And Gil, we're going for about an hour and then taking a break. Is that the plan?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So Genesis 29 is when Jacob is going to really get to his goal. If you remember, he had to flee because he had deceived his father. He had taken the blessing, the birthright of his brother Esau. Esau, understandably, is extremely angry to the point of wanting to kill him. And so mom and dad say, hey, we have an idea. Why don't you take a break from where we live? Why don't you go visit our relatives in Haran and find a wife there? So that's what's going to happen. In fact, that's one of the things that we are first introduced to. So in the beginning of Genesis 29, this is when he gets to where he's going, and he comes upon some shepherds, and they're basically just kind of lollygagging around this well. And then he begins to engage in conversation with them and finds out that, yes, that they know his relatives. In fact, they say, look, you see that girl coming there? That's actually the daughter of Laban. Now, what do guys do when they want to impress a girl, especially when they're younger guys? What's one of the things that guys do when they want to really show a girl what a great guy they are? You know, maybe boyfriend, possibly husband material. What's one of the first things? This is such a typical guy thing. What do we want to do? How are we going to try and impress the girl? We're going to show them how strong we are. That's right. Which is always just girls swoon, of course, when they see how strong guys are. That's what Jacob does. This whole story cracks me up. So he's engaging in this conversation with the shepherds. He's like, why are you watering the flock now? And they're like, well, we got to wait for somebody to roll the stone away. And every time the stone being rolled away, it's like they must do it. Like it takes more than one guy. Well, they have to, whoever they are, they've got to roll the stone away. It's a very heavy stone, we're told. So, of course, as soon as Jacob sees this beautiful, beautiful young woman coming toward him, who is his cousin, by the way, where are we at here? Verse 10, it came about when Jacob saw Rachel. We're told that Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance, I believe is the translation. She was good looking. So when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, so double impressive, the girl and the sheep. that Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the mouth of the well. Flex a little bit. We don't need a they. All we need is a me. I'm going to roll this stone away. And then we have one of the weirdest verses in all of Genesis, verse 11. Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. Anytime I talk about this verse, if there's any young men in the room, I do like to give, I don't give much relationship advice, but one bit of advice I always give to the young men is if you're out to impress a girl, don't kiss her and then start crying. It's not a good look. I mean, this had to have been extremely uncomfortable and awkward for Rachel. She doesn't even know this guy. He comes up, kisses her, and then starts to cry, and she's probably like, I don't even know what I did. But this is a strange character. Then he begins to tell her, okay, this is who I am. I'm your relative, so on and so forth. She goes and she tells Laban. Laban comes, and he greets Jacob and basically welcomes him into the house. So Jacob has found a temporary home that's going to be his home really for 20 years. He's found his relatives. Now, do you remember anything about Laban from earlier in the Genesis story? Because this is not the first time that we've met him. We actually meet him when Abraham has sent a servant to find a wife for Isaac once more with the family. You got to marry within the family. So this servant of Abraham goes to find a wife for Isaac. And when he gets there, he once more encounters this beautiful young woman. Remember her name? Rebecca. Yeah. So Rebecca. And then Rebecca has a brother, and that brother is Laban. And when we meet Laban, we're not going to take the time to look at it, but you can do that on your own. But when we meet Laban, one of the things we learn right away is that Laban's name in Hebrew means white. But he really should have had the Hebrew equivalent of green or gold because he was a money-loving kind of guy. Everything about him portrays him as someone who's really interested in getting stuff and having stuff, in wealth. And so that's kind of the first impression we have of Laban. And that first impression turns out to be the correct impression because throughout the Genesis story with Jacob and Laban, we find out that he's a grasping kind of guy. He's deceitful. He's mischievous. In fact, he's kind of a good competitor with Jacob for characteristics like that. But that's Laban. And right away in this story, we're going to find out how deceitful, how mischievous that Laban can be. Because what happens? Well, Jacob has already fallen in love with the girl that he kissed with Rachel. And so they kind of work out a deal. Laban says, you know, you're family, but that doesn't mean that you should work for me for nothing. So why don't we kind of work out a deal? What kind of wages can I offer you? And Jacob says, well, I tell you what, I'll work 7 years for you if I can marry Rachel. And Laban's like, sound like a pretty good deal to me. And so they do. And then we're introduced to a side of Jacob that I don't think that we've seen yet. Because verse 20 tells us that Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. And everybody says, aw. It's a heart. You know, I do think that's important because the Jacob we've seen so far, we've really only seen one side of him. And it's not a very great, it's not a pretty side. It's pretty ugly, right? But it turns out that people are always more complicated than we tend to think that they are. We tend to flatten people down. In fact, we might know a couple of things about a person and we're like, oh yeah, that's all of who they are. Well, of course, that's not the way anybody is. Everybody's much more complicated. We're multifaceted. We're multi-layered. There's a lot of characteristics, good and bad, to our personalities. And so we're finding out a little bit more about Jacob here. He's a man who can love intensely, love so much that working for 7 years is just a few days because of his love for her. So you can imagine his anticipation. He's ready to make her his wife. And so at the end of the 7 years, he approaches his boss, who's also his uncle, about to become his father-in-law, and says, we need to have a wedding. It's time. And so Laban says, great, let's have a wedding. So they get everybody together, they have a feast, and what's one of the things you always have at a wedding? Wine. you gotta have wine, right? This is a time of celebration, so you're gonna have the wine is gonna be flowing. They had beer in the ancient world. Maybe they had beer too. I mean, there's always plenty to eat, plenty to drink. It's a feast. Everybody's happy. They're eating, they're feasting, they're drinking. And what does the groom sometimes do in situations like this? Maybe has a little bit too much wine. Maybe a little bit too much. This didn't happen. I'm not saying this happened at any of your weddings. I'm not implying that. But you probably heard of situations where this occurred. I'm guessing that's what happened in this situation because, well, I'll just read you the story. I'll let the Bible itself tell you what happened. So they gather all the men of the place and made a feast. That's verse 22. Now it came about in the evening that Laban took his daughter Leah, she's the older of the two, and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. He had intercourse with her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. Now, this is my favorite verse in the entire Jacob story. By far, my favorite verse. Because this is just a great example of how the Bible can compress so much into just a few words. We don't need this all expanded out. We don't need this hammed up. It says it very briefly, and you can picture the entire scene. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. Exclamation point. Yeah. I mean, you can see it all happening, right?
Yeah.
You can see it all happening. Jacob rolls over, whatever it might be, and behold. It's not the woman that he expected. It's not the woman that he thought he had been making love to. It was Leah. And then, this is great. He goes to Laban and says, "What is this that you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me?" Do you taste the irony here? I mean, the deceiver has been deceived. The liar has been lied to. In fact, there's an old Jewish tradition about this where they say that in the morning, Jacob was just irate with Leah. And he said, "How when we were making love, did you keep? I kept saying to you, Rachel, Rachel, and you kept saying yes, yes. How could you have done that to me?" She says, "Well, in the same way that when your father was speaking to you, Esau, Esau, you kept saying yes, yes." The deceiver has been deceived. So now, Jacob is entering into a family situation that he never envisioned. Because he's married now to the wrong sister. He's married to the sister that we're told he didn't have any affection for. He was in love with Rachel. So what's he going to do? Well, Laban says, "I've got the solution. Listen, first of all, you just were unaware of the tradition of this place. So it's always our tradition here to marry the older sister first. I just didn't tell you that, and you were probably a little bit too far gone to realize that you were making love to the wrong woman. But here's what we'll do. I'll go ahead and give her sister to you. All you have to do is wait a week. We'll have another wedding, and then you can have Rachel." A lot of people are confused at this point. They think that Jacob had to work another 7 years and then get Rachel. That's not the way it worked. So he worked 7 years, he got Leah, and then waited a week or so, then he got Rachel, then he worked another 7 years for Rachel. So total of 14 years. So after, you know, a week or so, they have another wedding, another wife, and now Jacob has two wives, sister wives. Now, I don't have to tell you that because of this situation, there's going to be some problems. Like every single woman in the room is like, "Yes, Chad, there are going to be some problems here." I mean, it would be bad enough if you had two women who were unrelated who are now co-wives. But if you have two sisters who are co-wives, yeah, some of you, I can actually visually see the cringing on many of the females' faces here. So, yeah, and we know that this did lead to all kinds of problems. Jealousy, obviously. But this jealousy was manifested in kind of a, what I like to think of as a baby-making competition between these two wives. And this was not only prompted by the desire to have children, this maternal desire to have children, but also by the desire, at least on Leah's part, to win the affection of her husband, which for me is one of the saddest parts of the Jacob story. She thought that if she had a son, or maybe a second son, or maybe a third son, or maybe a fourth or fifth, whatever it is, that eventually Jacob's heart would turn toward her and not so much toward Leah. So as the story continues, we're told that she began to have these sons. First of all, she had Reuben. Now, listen to the reason behind these names. So the firstborn is Reuben. And she named him that because she said, because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. The name Reuben in Hebrew is related to the verb for see. So that's why he's named what he is. But did you hear that? Maybe God will see my affliction, and now my husband will love me. They try again. She conceives, bears another son. She says, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. So she named him Simeon, which is related to the verb for hear, Shema. Number 3, verse 34. She conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will become attached to me. That's the verb lava, which means to attach oneself, because I have borne him 3 sons. So she named him Levi. Reuben, Simeon, Levi. All 3 names of these boys are an indication of the emotional distress in which she found herself. Every single time she was hinging her hopes upon the birth of a son. I've given him this son, he's going to love me. It didn't work. I'm going to give him this son, he's going to love me. It didn't work. Now I'm going to give him this son, it didn't. And maybe he'll love me now. No. I mean, it is, if nothing else, a great example of how we might try to, as it were, earn someone's love by doing whatever it is we think is going to accomplish this, and it doesn't work that way. Love can't be bought, as it were. Love can't be earned. But in this sad state of affairs, that's what's going on with her. Now, I did want to point one thing out, and this is, we talked about this earlier today. Leah is described as the wife who is, in the Hebrew, hated. In fact, it's sometimes translated as unloved. Verse 31 says that. So verse 30 says, he loved Rachel more than Leah, which implies what? He had some love for her, right? He loved her more than he loved the other. But then verse 31 says, when the Lord saw that Leah was hated, he opened her womb. So this is probably the best explanation for this, and this is pretty widespread opinion in the scholarship too, is that when hated is used here, it doesn't mean what we think of when we think of hated, this kind of this deep-seated antagonism towards someone. It's more of a technical term for someone who is not the preferred, not the chosen one. In this case, it's the wives. And so Rachel was the chosen one. She was the one to whom his heart was directed. She was the one that he wanted to be with. Leah was not. So she was the hated one. Now, I bring this up because this actually has implications for another well-known biblical verse. And that is, Jacob I've loved, and Esau I have hated. Now, I think what's going on there is the same thing that's going on here. Who was the one that was chosen by God to be the one who would carry on the promise of the Messianic seed? Jacob. And so he was the one that God loved. He was the one that God chose to be the one who's going to carry on this promise. He did not choose Esau. And so Esau was hated. It wasn't that God had some deep-seated antagonism toward Esau. It just was that he was not the one who was chosen by God to be the one who would carry on this promise. And I think that sheds a lot of light on the way that God works in the biblical story and what can sometimes be misconstrued as divine hatred towards certain individuals. It's a matter of him choosing to use a certain person as part of his unfolding salvation story. And that was kind of a theological aside. Now back to the situation that we find ourselves in here. You got Jacob married to the two wives. And then you have the beginning birth, at least, of some sons. And then we hear more about this as we slip into chapter 30, because what do the two wives now begin to do in this competition? They expand the team. They each have a servant. And so it was fairly common in the ancient world, you could do this legally, where you allow your husband to have a child with your servant, and then this child will be legally yours. She's a surrogate mother, basically. That's what happens now with these two wives, these two sisters. They're bringing in their servants also, who also begin then to have children. Now, just kind of put yourself into the family dynamics of what's happening here, too. What's going to be, probably, what's going to be the attitude of the sons of the maidservants? What are they going to feel like? Second rate, second class. And we see as they grow up and as we learn more about the Jacob story, we see actually this developing. We see this jealousy. We see this sense of superiority. We certainly see on Jacob's part a preference for certain sons of the beloved wife, right? Joseph and Benjamin in particular. What's going on here? We have an evolving mess, right? We've got a family that, at least from the outside, and even when you get into the inside, it is getting pretty ugly. We got jealousy. We've got competition. With the birth of these children, we're going to have fraternal problems between brothers and probably sisters as well. And this whole family situation, this whole family dynamic, is the beginning. Of what is going to grow into the people of God. Let's go. Let that sit for a minute. So Jacob's name is going to be changed to what later on? Israel. So Israel, the man, his name becomes the name, of course, of Israel, the people. And then Jacob is going to have 12 sons, right? And these 12 sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Joseph, all these, they're going to be the what? The tribes. So kind of take stock of the big Israel and now come back here to these chapters in Genesis. And what are you looking at here? You're looking at, to use Christian language, you're looking at this family of four wives and a growing number of children and jealousy and manipulation and all sorts of dysfunction happening with this family. This is what we would say in Christianity is the Old Testament church. This is the Old Testament church. This is the nucleus. This is how it all begins. With Jacob / Israel and the 12 patriarchs all together, all having some pretty major dysfunction going on. Now, besides just being an interesting observation, what significance does that have? Well, the significance it has reverberates to our very day. Because it turns out the community of God, this family of Jacob, or later the nation of Israel, or get to the book of Acts, the church, or the church still today, it all had its beginning here, and it continues to manifest these same characteristics still today. So when you look at a church, none of your churches. We'll just pick a church that you know, not yours. And you look at it, and much of the time, what do you have in that church? You got dysfunction. You got problems. I'm not saying that everything about the church is dysfunctional, but every church is going to have issues. Why? Well, because every church is comprised of a whole bunch of sinners. And I don't care how good their pastor is, that pastor is also a sinner. And so when you have this kind of group coming together, you're going to have problems. And that's okay. That's okay because it turns out that that has always been the way the community of God has been. And that community of God is loved by God, is cared for by Him. I'm not saying that you don't try to work on those parts that are wrong. Of course you do. I'm not saying that you, as it were, turn a blind eye to dysfunction. Of course you don't. But you don't expect to come to church and find it just this perfect, ideal community. It never is. In fact, it's not designed to be. It's designed to be a place where hurting and broken and messed up people come together with other hurting and broken and messed up people so that together we could actually be there for each other. We can love each other. We can forgive each other. We can manifest to each other the same compassion that we ourselves need to receive. This certainly predated 2020, but we've certainly seen it since 2020. Still growing and still a problem where people have kind of separated themselves from the body of believers. And they're trying to make it on their own. That's a very, very dangerous place to be. Because number one, we are not created to be alone. All of us are created to be in community. We are social creatures. That's the way God made us to be. In fact, what's the first not good of the Bible? You have all this good, 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 very good. And then you hear, oh, it was not good for the man to be alone. It's not good for the woman to be alone. It's not good for us to be alone. We need to be in some sort of community. That's just the way we're made to be. And certainly it applies in the case of our spiritual lives. We don't need Lone Ranger Christians. We don't need people who kind of cut themselves off from the community because we all need each other. I need people and they need me. To go back to the exile theme, that's one of the things that I discovered in spades when I've entered into these periods of exile in my own life is that, man, thanks be to God for the people He's placed in my midst during those times because I don't think I could have made it on my own. In fact, when I was on my own, things were really, really bad. I needed people around me to keep me sane, to listen to me, to love me, to forgive me, to help me, to encourage me, to pray for me. We all need that. And sometimes people do that for us, sometimes we do that for other people. But that's why God formed this community. That's why He formed this family around Jacob. That's why He continued to nurture the people of God throughout the centuries, and that's why we still have the church today, because it's a place for, you know, the church is often called a hospital for the wounded. It's not a gym where you come and work out, you know, you flex in front of the mirror, show everybody how spiritually strong you are. It's a place where you come after a really hard week, and you kind of drag yourself in, wounded and bleeding, and you come there because you find other people who are wounded and bleeding there, and above all else, you find there the healing medicine of Christ, who comes to forgive us, to say, I love you, to say, you don't have to be perfect. You can't be perfect when you come into church. You come imperfect. You come flawed, and I'm here to love you as the great physician of soul and body. And not only that, but then He gets people around us who love us and help us toward healing as well. So when there's problems in the church, I'm never shocked. I'm always shocked when there's not problems in the church. That's what surprises me. You mean, really, what's going on behind the scenes? You know, you come to a church where everybody seems to like have themselves put together and there's peace, and I'm like, are you sure? Because this seems very unnatural to me. I mean, there are churches like that. Thanks be to God for them. But most of us, you know, we're just a bunch of misfits in one way or another, whether we like to admit that or not. We're a bunch of misfits who come together with other misfits, and we find a God who loves us as we are and who embraces us and gives us the forgiveness and the healing and the peace that we so desperately need. And that, I think, is one of the takeaways from Jacob's family. This is the nucleus of the Old Testament people of God. It will simply grow from here. And if you think this is ugly, well, read 1 and 2 Samuel. Read 1 and 2 Kings. It gets worse. It gets uglier. And yet God still calls these people His bride, His beloved. They are His people. And it's the same with the church. So it's encouragement to me when I see stories like this about the family of God, the community of God, Because it makes me realize, hey, you know, our churches, our congregations are no different. And they don't have to be perfect in order to be God's chosen and beloved community. So that's kind of the family side of what's going on here with Jacob. And I will add this too. I think, you know, Jacob had a very strange marriage situation, of course, because he's married to these four different women. But if we kind of leave that aside and think about what Jacob was forced to learn in those marriages and what we often are forced to learn in our own marriages, I think that's instructive as well, because I like to think of marriage as the ideal place of discipleship. The reason is because what happens in marriage is that, to kind of piggyback off what I was just saying, you take a sinner and a sinner and you say, okay, I want you to live together. I want you to share everything. Share the same bank account, share the same bathroom counter, share the same vehicles, you know, share the same vacations. I want you to share everything. Now, when you do that, I don't care how much in love these two people are, there's going to be challenges. That's a neutral word, isn't it? There will be challenges. Because what you're doing is you're taking two people who are by nature concerned about themselves, and you're saying, now I want you to be fully concerned about somebody else. Well, that's what we might call a challenge, right? And because, you know, there's going to be good days, there's going to be bad days, but you're bringing two sinners together and you're saying, okay, now I want you to empty out yourself in the sense of I want you to be empty so that the other person can fill you, and that other person can be empty so that you can fill them, and you can complete each other in that sense of becoming one flesh. And that's hard. It's challenging. It's beautiful. It's all these things wrapped together. And Jacob began to learn this himself, and of course, we learn it as well. This is one of the ways in which God is uncurving us, as I talked about last night. We are by nature curved in ourselves, and so God places someone in our midst that we love and serve, and he's uncurving us so that we no longer are navel-gazers, but we're gazing at our neighbor instead, in particular our spouse. So when we move into the house of marriage, that's one of the things that God is doing. He is teaching us what it means to sacrifice, what it means to serve, what it means to love this person that he has placed in our midst. Now, how well Jacob did that? Probably not that great, but turns out we don't do it that great either. I mean, with the exception of, like, my wife, who loves me perfectly. But as a husband, I fail. No matter how hard I try, and you know exactly what that feels like. And that's all right, because that failure then gives the other spouse a chance to say, you know what, I love you and I forgive you. And when they fail, it gives us a chance to say, I love you and I forgive you. And so we're practicing the art of forgiveness as we learn what it means to be a follower of Christ. And part of being a follower of Christ is sacrificing our own interest for the sake of the other. So Jacob he's married to these women, he's having these kids, and he's also having to deal at the same time with a very difficult boss, who's also his uncle, who's also his father-in-law, who's also his Pharaoh character. Laban is definitely, in this exile story, he's kind of a Pharaoh character in the sense of he's the one who is oppressing Jacob. He's changing his wages. He's deceived him with regard to the wives. He's making Jacob's life extremely difficult. And no doubt for Jacob that was hard, but at the same time, this was the way, I think, finally in Jacob's life, God is beginning to get through to him. He's put Jacob in a situation where he has to care for others. He's no longer just caring about himself. He's forced to care for his wives and for his kids. He's forced to work. He's forced to do all these things. So God is also uncurving Jacob. He's pointing him outward. And he's using these hardships and these afflictions that are often coming from Laban in order to humble Jacob. In other words, God is using exile. He's using this period that I like to call Jacob's winter, to make it fruitful in his life. So I like to call this phase in Jacob's life the fruitful winter. And don't think that that's very difficult for us to understand as well, because when we enter into periods of exile, when it feels like we're kind of in a winter situation, as Lewis would say, a winter with no Christmas. You know, we're suffering, we're cold, we're wondering when there's going to be, you know, peace and contentment again. When we're in those periods of life, when we have our own Labans, whoever that might be, a literal boss, right? Or it might be a family member, or it might be whoever it is. When we have a Laban who is making our life very difficult, what God is beginning to do is he's beginning to teach us what it means to cast all our cares upon him and to learn what it means to embrace humility and to learn what it means to kind of come to the end of ourselves. I think the culmination of this in Jacob's life is going to be when he wrestles with this mysterious figure that we'll talk about in our next hour. But God is beginning to, he's already beginning, as it were, to wrestle with Jacob. He's beginning to use this winter in his life in order to bring Jacob to the point to where he wants him to be. And he does that in our own lives as well. It doesn't have to be in a period of intense pain. It can be just kind of the day-to-day lives that we live. But God is always, he's always trying to bring us down, in the sense of bring us to humility, in order that we might realize that all our hope and all our life and all our peace has always been wrapped up in him and not in ourselves. Because we're easily deluded into thinking that, especially when things are going well in our lives, we're easily deluded into thinking that we have control. We're doing okay. And so what God will often do is make sure that we're not okay, in order that in that time, he can begin to actually do the work in our lives that he desires to do. And that's what he was doing with Jacob, especially in his interactions with Laban. Now, I want to kind of wrap up this part of the story and pull it toward where we're going to pick up with the next hour. And I want to do that by talking about kind of the end of this period in Jacob's life. So he's been there for 20 years, long time to be in exile. He left with a stick, and now he's got four wives, or two wives and two co-wives. All of his sons, with one exception, Benjamin, are going to be born in exile. Which itself is pretty instructive, isn't it? The patriarchs, I mean, the heads of the 12 tribes are, with one exception, are all born outside the promised land. And they have to get there, but they're born in exile. God has to bring them back. So all these kids are being born. And if you know the story about remember the speckled and the spotted sheep and the goats and all that? God is using that in order to take what Laban had designed as a way of impoverishing Jacob to actually enrich Jacob. That's another thing that happens in exile. We often go into it empty, and then while we're there, God fills us before he brings us back. So God is filling Jacob. He's making this man who entered into exile alone with a stick and a promise in his pocket, he's making him now a father, a husband, a man with wealth and power, because he's going to have servants, he's going to have all these animals. God is, in other words, God is taking Jacob into a place where you would think he had no hope. No hope. And there he is filling him to overflowing with hope. In a place where it seemed everything would be against Jacob, that's where God was especially for him and was filling him with all these blessings. And he's getting ready then, having done all this work in Jacob's life over the course of 20 years, of enriching him, of blessing him, of just pouring this divine generosity into his life, he's now bringing him back. But before he does, there has to be a reconciliation. And this is actually one of my favorite parts of this section of Jacob's life. His reconciliation, I guess we could call it that, his reconciliation with Laban. So you may remember how this worked. Jacob agrees with his wives that they're going to go home. In fact, it seems as if the daughters of Laban are fed up with Laban too. They're like, well, he's taken everything away from us, so let's just go. But they don't go up to Laban and say, hey, we're sick of you, we're leaving. They wait until he's gone quite a ways away, shearing sheep, and they're like, okay, pack everything up, we're leaving. So they leave, and you kind of picture them later, they're taking off. They're going to get out of here before Laban has a chance to find them. So they take off. Well, they're gone quite a ways. Laban finds out. He gathers all his men together, and they chase after them. And I think one of the reasons that I think they chase after him, because Jacob had been a source of blessing for Laban for a long time. He doesn't want to lose him, right? But he finally catches up with him. And this could have gone really badly, because Laban is angry. Jacob has no good feelings toward Laban. So you got two guys who've had a lot of problems with each other. And Laban is upset because Jacob is running away. But the night before, God had appeared to Laban and said, basically, you leave Jacob alone. So when he comes and confronts Jacob, he's pretending as if he's so upset that Jacob took his grandchildren away and his daughters away before he could kiss them and tell them goodbye. I don't think anybody was buying this story, by the way. Anybody who knew Laban would be like, oh, you act really well, but we all know who you really are. And then we have the whole story of, remember Rachel had stolen the household gods? It's part of the story too. And so he says, why did you steal my gods? And so he begins to search through all of their stuff to try and find these little figurines that Rachel had stolen. But anyway, we kind of get to the climax of that part of the story. And this is the part that I think is so helpful for us. Jacob and Laban, finally, after they've kind of been in each other's faces, upset, throwing accusations back and forth, they finally reach the point where they're like, you know what? Let's just make a treaty. Let's make peace. And we will agree that I'm going to go that way, and you're going to go that way, and you're going to take care of my daughters, your wives, and we'll never see each other again. Jacob agreed to this. Laban agreed to this. They made peace. They forgave each other, as it were. And then Laban went back home, and Jacob and his wives went the other direction, never to see each other again. I love to point out this story to people, because we've all had these situations in life where we labor under the guilt, the false guilt, of thinking that we not only have to forgive those who have sinned against us, but we need to still be actively present in their lives. And anytime that comes up, I like to say, oh yeah? Have you read the story of Jacob and Laban? I think this is extremely liberating, because we've all been around people that it's like gasoline and a match. I mean, just any time that we are together, there's issues, there's problems. It just, and no matter how many times we maybe forgive each other, there's still going to be problems. That's Jacob and Laban. And so sometimes it's best to make peace, to forgive, to reconcile, and to say, you have a good life. Because then that allows us, first of all, to forgive and to be at peace and to be reconciled. And then to go our separate ways and to live in love and freedom and to serve those who are around us without necessarily being an active part of this other person's life. Sometimes that is wisest and sometimes that is best. Now, that's not an excuse for kind of, you know, getting out of situations that are a little bit difficult for us. It's not that, but it is a legitimate biblical example of how sometimes it is best for us to make peace and to reconcile and then to say, God bless you, and I hope that you have a good life. But we all know that you and I don't go well together. And so I'll be there and you will be there. And I'm thankful. I'm thankful that they made peace. I'm thankful that they were able to reconcile. They made this treaty, as it were, and they went their separate ways. And we don't know what happened with Laban. We certainly know what happened with Jacob after this. But this was a good way to end the exile. It was a good way to end it in peace, to say, you know what, we're good. And now I'm going to continue my homeward journey, and then you will go back to your home as well. So we're at the end of the 20 years. What's going to happen to Jacob next? Well, if you remember from last night, at the beginning of this exile, God appeared to him at night when he was alone and spoke to him. Well, at the end of the exile, we'll talk about this in our next hour, at the end of the exile, God appeared to Jacob once more, alone and at night. But he didn't speak with him. He fought with him. And that's where we're going to pick it up in our next hour together when we get to the wrestling match between this mysterious figure and Jacob. Now, we got about 5 minutes. I have about 5 minutes before the end of the hour. So if anybody has a question or two, we have time for that. And then we're going to take a quick break and then we'll do our next hour together. Okay, good. So questions. Only easy questions, Miriam. Yeah, that's a good question. It seems to be because Rachel named her son as well. There's a strange. Am I getting this right? In the book of Ruth, isn't it the women of the town that name the child who's born to Ruth and Boaz? Maybe I'm mistaken about that, but we have examples where the mothers are those who choose the names. So it was their prerogative. John the Baptist. Yeah, and the townspeople didn't like the name. Why are you naming him John? You don't have any relatives by that name. Yes, sir.
In their final match, the Guiler has been sent to the Super Guiler, but as it resolves in 32 or 33, so my honesty will answer. He's not being honest with him. He's finally come up with the final deception to relieve himself of this problem. But
yeah.
I would assume that aided Laban's life for the rest of his life, that he had been the final guiling, if you want to say, that he had met his match.
Yeah, those Jacob and Laban together were a match for beguiling.
My honesty will answer for me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, it's... You often have these statements in Scripture, which I'm sure were not meant to be hilarious by the speaker, but they are from our perspective, such as when Joseph's brothers, much later in the story, show up in Egypt, and Joseph is the head guy, and Joseph accuses him of being spies. And remember what their response is? Oh, no, we're all honest men. See, that's why it's so much fun to study the Bible. The reason it's fun to study the Bible is because the Bible is full of people, and people are hilarious. We're all funny. I mean, it's often in kind of, gallows humor sort of way, but we are funny creatures. We can laugh at each other. We can laugh at ourselves because we're always saying and doing stupid things, which are sometimes very funny. And you find that in the Bible. That's once you realize biblical characters are real people, all of a sudden you begin to realize how funny these characters are. And the weird, the funny, the stupid things they say. And so we can read the Bible and we can laugh because it's just people being people. Okay, any other questions right now?
Why is Leah described as having weak eyes?
Oh, thank you for asking that. So, Leah is often depicted as the ugly sister, right? When that adjective is translated in Hebrew it's rock, which it's R-A-K, but it sounds just like our R-O-C-K. When that is translated, it's often translated as weak. But most of the time when that adjective is used, it means something like soft and gentle. So that would probably be, in my opinion, a better translation. She had soft or gentle eyes. Now, what does that mean? This is a way of saying that she had that great feature. Now, I don't know what the rest of her looked like. But she did have soft, gentle eyes. I think what's being accented there is not that she was ugly, but she was no match for her sister, because we're told that Rachel was hot, basically. That's my translation of Hebrew there. She was beautiful in form and appearance. It means she had a beautiful face, she had a beautiful figure. She was good looking. And Leah had great eyes. We don't know what the rest of her looked like. Maybe she was a pretty girl, but she just was no match for her sister. But yeah, that rather than weak eyes, I translate that as like soft or gentle eyes.
Could it be she didn't see what was being, how she was being used.
Maybe that's kind of an implication of that. Yeah.
She didn't understand the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. She's very much, my heart goes out to her because she was very much an unwilling participant in all of this. At least that's the way that I read the story. You know, she was just doing basically what her dad wanted her to do. And then she's in a marriage where she's not the chosen one. But I'll end with this. I'm glad that you pointed that out. It is and Jack actually is one that pointed this out to me some time ago. When you get to the very end of the story, Rachel dies first, of course. She dies in childbirth with Benjamin. When you get to the very end of the story and Jacob dies, who's he buried with? He's buried with Leah. They end up together. And more importantly, I would argue, if we could go back in time and sit down with Leah and say, listen, I know that things are hard. I know that you're not the chosen wife, and I know that this is a very difficult marriage for you. But let me tell you something. You know that fourth son born to you, the one that you named after the praise of the Lord, Yehudah, Judah? Guess who he's going to be? He's going to be the one who has a tribe named after him. And from that tribe will come one named David. And from David's family will come the son of David, the Messiah. So, Leah, be of good cheer, because not from your sister's line, but from your line will come forth the one who is the salvation and the peace and the healing for the world. So if we could go back in time and tell sad Leah that story, I think she would laugh with delight. We'll take our break now.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.